Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, with Martin Luther King Day behind us, I've been thinking quite a lot about the dream of equality in this country. In some ways, we've come so far, and yet it still seems we have far to go. But at least we're starting to see some meaningful parity with the passage of the health care law.
So many people who struggled in the past to afford health coverage due to near poverty or pre-existing conditions now covered, and not just covered, but covered with good insurance, making a big difference in their lives and, for that matter, millions of lives around the country.
There's a notable drop in the number of people who put off accessing health care services due to the cost or lack of coverage. It's the first time those numbers have gone down since the Commonwealth Fund began tracking those numbers.
Well, I think it's important to note, too, though, that the study showed that folks who live closer to the poverty line still had trouble paying all their medical bills, and that's primarily due to the plans with higher out-of-pocket costs. But even those numbers showed some improvement.
As we know, Margaret, the best pathway to better health is facilitating access to preventative care. And with millions of Americans newly covered under the health care law, we should continue to see some steady improvement.
How we access care in general is also changing, Mark. We have a new era of healthcare where televisits will be very sufficient to fill many of our healthcare needs. Smartphone apps can track most of our essential health data. All of this, hopefully, serving to help patients be more empowered in their own care. And that's something our guest today is one of the world's thought leaders on.
Dr. Eric Topol is a practicing cardiologist and the director of Scripps Translational Science Institute. He's a champion of the potential for genomics and telemedicine to reshape the future of healthcare. He'll be chatting with us about his newest book, The Patient Will See You Now.
Well, it's always a pleasure to hear from Dr. Topol. And Lori Robertson will be checking in. She's always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health reform in the public domain.
But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And if you have comments, email us at chcradio@chc1.com. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. Now we'll get to our interview with Dr. Topol in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. What you pay depends on where you live. As tens of millions of Americans gain insurance coverage under the Affordable Care Act, rates do vary widely across the country. While insurance rates in Colorado actually went down slightly, largely due to more choices for those purchasing insurance, folks in Alaska saw an average 30% hike in costs for standard silver plans on the exchange. Turns out Sunbelt states tend to have rates on the lower end of the spectrum on average. A milestone in the Ebola outbreak, schools were reopened last week across the small West African country of Guinea, one of the hardest hit Ebola hotspots. So far, the disease has been largely contained to that region of the African continent. More than 20,000 have been infected. Roughly half of those patients have died. One of the challenges for scientists battling this current outbreak of Ebola, the genetic structure has changed about 3% from its 1970s genetic makeup. The mutation makes drug development a little more uncertain. China is confirming at least 15 serious cases of bird flu in recent weeks, three of whom have died. The rest are critical. And while China is beginning to look to renewable energy as a replacement for current fossil fuel use, air quality continues to deteriorate across the country to multiple times the legal limit for breathing. Toxic air in China is believed to be responsible for 750,000 deaths per year. And smoking is a choice that leads to an estimated 450,000 deaths per year in the U.S. The online financial site WalletHub did an analysis showing smoking costs the American economy some $300 billion plus dollars per year. The average smoker, if they smoke and survive over a lifetime, will have spent about $1.2 million on cigarettes and will incur an average of $150,000 in medical bills and will lose an average of $200,000 of lifetime earnings due to smoking-related illness. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Eric Topol, cardiologist and director of Scripps Translational Science Institute in La Jolla, California, an expert on the use of telemedicine and genomics in healthcare. Dr. Topol has written several critically acclaimed books, including The Creative Destruction of Medicine, and most recently, The Patient Will See You Now, The Future of Medicine is in Your Hands. He earned his medical degree at the University of Rochester, where he was awarded the highest honor, the Hutchinson Medal, for his contributions. Dr. Topol, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you.
It's been about 3 years since you joined us on the show, and so much has changed over this short time since we've chatted. The discipline of genomics and telemedicine have exploded in areas that you say are poised to be the two biggest game changers in healthcare. Your new book, just recently published, The Patient Will See You Now, you examine how far we've come in putting the power of healthcare into consumers' hands. And tell our listeners what have been some of the most exciting developments in the medicalization of smartphones.
It's really been an extraordinary jump in the technology where what was a smartphone that changed our everyday lives, it has now become capable of a hub of medicine. That is, not just that you could capture all your sensor data like your vital signs, do your labs, do imaging, but also, of course, things like your physical exam, being able to summon a doctor either immediately through your video secure link or even to your home. So it's become a device, this little device, that could really transform medicine. It could democratize medicine by super empowering consumers.
Well, Dr. Topol, you've likened this phase we're entering in the world of healthcare as akin to the development of the Gutenberg press, which democratized access to the written word. And you note that there's a longstanding tradition of what one could call paternalism. But as you said, the free flow of information from patient to providers has the potential to democratize healthcare in a way never seen. So expand on that a little bit for us.
Well, for all these years, millennia, the doctors have been in control, and patients didn't have access to their own data.
Right.
Well, that's going to change drastically because not only are things digitized, but now patients are generating their data. That data is going to their phones that they own about their own body. What's going to happen in the short term is that we have a whole new model where the patient will see you now. That is much more in charge than ever before. And in fact, access to information not just about themselves, but for example, cost data. You know, cost data has been an unmentionable part mm-hmm. of medicine. But now that all that data will be accessible through one's mobile device. So these things are all happening at once. It's happening quickly. And of course, we have this paternalism that you mentioned. And this, of course, has to give way to this altered, I think, very improved model. Now, your point about the Gutenberg and democratization of information and reading, I do think that this has the parallel of our time in medicine because we go from the medical community controlling everything to a whole different look where it's bottoms up, a great inversion of how medicine is practiced.
You know, we just recently had entrepreneur and angel investor Esther Dyson on the show talking about what she looks for when investing in health technology. And she said she thinks non-invasive sensors hold the promise for disrupting the status quo in healthcare. It's going to generate a lot of data, all that needs to be secure to travel through. And that's an area that still needs some work. Tell our listeners where we are in this to make sure that the information is secure.
You brought up two critical points. One is about privacy and security of the data, which we do not have safeguarded in any way. There's been great white papers written by the White House, but no action has been taken to control the data, to prevent its sale. Right now, the medical data, which is so precious and needs to be preserved as private, we don't have that nailed down at all. That has to get righted. The other thing that you brought up is about the analytical side. And, you know, in the Wall Street Journal piece, I talked about how we're pathetic at analytics,
right.
and we are. That is, we hoard all this data, big data, but we do very little processing and analytics of data, and part of that is we don't have the talent to write all the algorithms and do all this great analytics, and we have right now, for example, Esther Dyson is right, the sensors whether they're wearable or other ways that we can track one's own information. How is that going to get processed? And ultimately, how is that going to be used for predictive analytics to prevent and preempt illness, which is certainly possible. And so we are way behind in the analytics. We're way behind in the security and privacy. We've got to work on that. That's what's holding us back right now.
I'd like you to take a closer look at telemedicine and the promise this holds for increasing patients' direct access to a provider. And are we seeing with the burgeoning of telemedicine and virtual visits? But you see telemedicine as a game changer. And I'd like for you to just paint a picture for us, if you would, of how practices will need to change to embrace this promise of telemedicine.
Yeah, I think the telemedicine is just one dimension to this mobile device makeover. And that is because it takes so long to get an appointment with a primary care doctor. The average is over 2 to 3 weeks, in some cities as much as 6 weeks. Well, that's not going to work. You know, this whole concept of, instead of there's an app for that, there's an Uber for that. And that is this whole thing about you can get what you want immediately.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you need to get a consult, you can do that now. Now, that doesn't mean to undermine your primary care doctor, but the mismatch of demand and supply is profound. And part of it is financial. That is, it costs the same to get an immediate video consult as it does for a copay if you go to the doctor and wait several weeks. So and you get your answer to your question on an immediate basis. And not only that, but telemedicine is going to get enriched because you can do a lot of the physical exam yourself. You can do all this data accumulation about yourself on the relevant condition. And so we're not talking about just two people having a video chat. We're talking about actually reviewing of information about the person or the child or whatever. So this is a very exciting area. We're not geared up for this. None of the medical schools in the United States, 140 schools, teach their students how to be good telemedical doctors. Someday, that's going to be part of every medical practice.
We're speaking today with Dr. Eric Topol, director of the Scripps Translational Institute in La Jolla, California. Dr. Topol has a new book, The Patient Will See You Now. The future of medicine is in your hands. Let's take a look at the role of genomics. It's increasingly playing a role in tailored protocols for treating things like cancer. In fact, you cite the case of Angelina Jolie, who lost her mother to ovarian cancer, and she had herself tested for the BRCA gene, which increases the likelihood of both breast and ovarian cancer, and chose to take a proactive approach. Can you tell us why you find her case so compelling?
She's a real sign of our times. That famous op-ed that she wrote, My Choice,
right.
Her choice of having this mutation screening. And then after finding that she had one of the serious mutations, to have the bilateral mastectomy, and her choice of trying to teach the world about her whole situation, each individual gets to make the call. This isn't for everyone, but the point is this is an opportunity of having access to their information. She's also going to undergo ovarian removal. And these are not a lightweight decision. So the fact that she is such an immense public figure, you know, you can have your own genome sequence, and over the next few years, millions of people are going to have their genome sequence, and that's going to help in making choices for each of those individuals.
I guess the question is it possible to do this absent ever having in-person contact or having a relationship with the primary care provider? Hypertension would lend itself to being diagnosed because you checked your own blood pressure. Certainly, you know, the physical exam, one could use the stethoscope component of the smartphone. One could do a micro drop of blood pretty soon and get all of their lipid panel and so forth. I guess as a cardiologist, are you comfortable with thinking that all of this can happen outside of ever needing to see the person? Are we really moving to a place where all of this can be done remotely?
Well, not all of it, so much of it. The fact that the intimacy of the human touch factor between a doctor and patient, I don't believe that's ever going to get lost, but I do think it's going to be decompressed. So the fact that you can offload back to the patient a lot of this data collection, and for example, you mentioned hypertension, Margaret. Well, there will be a watch or ways to get blood pressure every heartbeat going to your phone, and while you're sleeping, while you're in traffic, times we never even had that measurement before.
Mm-hmm.
These are not things that doctors have that context, but the consumers do, and that's what's a whole different look here. So basically, you've got this consumer patient armed with their information, and then we come together for providing guidance and the wisdom and experience of the doctor. That is so much of the doctor's work today, besides having to fill out forms, collecting data, that the person eventually will do almost all their routine lab tests themselves.
Dr. Topol, we recently had Dr. Eric Veery on the show, the medical director of the X Prize competition, and we're getting closer to that ever handheld diagnostic tool that really puts the power of healthcare management in the hands of consumers. And you also note that things are changing in medical school arena as well. For instance, medical students at Mount Sinai in New York are no longer being given stethoscopes, but instead are being trained to use smartphones with sensors. I don't know how we're going to recognize them as physicians without the stethoscope around their neck. Tell us not only about the cultural changes that are going on within medicine, but the revolution in technology. How is it going to assist clinicians in their task and the implications for training new providers?
Well, this is all part of this across-the-board revolution in the stethoscope, which is the icon of medicine. And as you've pointed out, Mark, you know, it's how you identify healthcare professionals. It's an obsolete 200-year-old analog.
But I love my
recording anything. I know, but it's worthless. Basically, listening to sounds. I mean, I used to teach on rounds. I mean, I loved it. That's how I was trained. You know, all the splitting of the second heart sound, all these things.
Galloping.
Yeah, all that stuff. It's all a bunch of past tense. You know, it's like you can see everything with a high-resolution ultrasound you can carry in your pocket. And once you see everything, you say, why would I ever listen to that stuff? That is so old. Because, you know, we order 130 million ultrasound studies a year in this country, which is, you know, well over $100 billion. If we just used this as part of our physical exam, we wouldn't have to order too many of those studies.
Well, we just had Stephen Brill on the line last week on the show, and he would agree with you.
Stephen is right on. I mean, but in effect, in his book that just came out, I mean, he didn't really get into this whole side of the innovation, which is, of course, that's what was really, so extraordinary, so remarkable, that we can harness things that exist today and have drastic reductions in cost, but we're not doing it because of the profound resistance within the medical community.
We could go on for hours with you, but let me see if I can wrap up with the question that's always front and center in my mind on this. All of this makes perfect sense, particularly around single, isolated issues for patients. But when people, and particularly we would say perhaps people we're most familiar with, people who are low income and confronted with lots of different complex challenges in their lives present, it's rarely for an issue, it's for an entire kind of multiplicity of issues. What's the solution out there for complexity in healthcare, as complex as treating hypertension or rashes or those things which are often put forward when we talk about telemedicine and e-consults and apps are? It's when you wrap all that up, wrap it in the context of people's emotional lives, their health habits, chronic illness, as well as preventive care needs, that things get kind of sticky. What do you see out there? Is that the place where the provider still sort of has a place for separating things out with people and helping them get a handle on many issues, not just single issues?
Right. I mean, this is, as you're alluding to, not a simple matter. I do want to just touch on the poor and the digital divide for a moment, though, because you mentioned that, Margaret. And that is, it may wind up being far more prudent to give people smartphones who don't have it and service contracts, because that's a total minor cost compared to, you know, $4,500 a night in the hospital,
right,
and all the other things that are involved with emergency room visits in our healthcare system today. In fact, we've just done a trial where we gave, in a randomized trial, where we gave half the people the device and service contract. So there is a digital divide that exists. There is a problem around the world without access to care. Mm-hmm. But there's a new way of collecting data and information for each individual. And what I've learned is that patients are really eager to have their data. Mm-hmm. That, you know, and all the surveys indicate 80 to 90% would like to have their data and information. But the precious involvement to review that with a doctor will never be lost. It's just that it's a different way of going forward. It's something that it's an evolving way of a partnership. And to me, that's exciting. Mm-hmm. If we let it happen.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Eric Topol, cardiologist and director of Scripps Translational Science Institute in La Jolla, California. Dr. Topol's new book is out, The Patient Will See You Now. The Future of Medicine is in Your Hands. You can learn more about his work by going to stsiweb.org, or you can follow him on Twitter at Eric Topol. Dr. Topol, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lurie Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lurie, what have you got for us this week?
Well, do retiring members of Congress get free medical care for life? No, they don't. A chain email about House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi makes that false claim and also greatly exaggerates what Pelosi could receive as a pension. We'll stick with the health care claim. Members of Congress don't receive free health care while they're in office or upon retirement. Under the Affordable Care Act, beginning in 2014, insurance coverage for members of Congress switched from the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program, that's the government's employer-sponsored private insurance market for federal employees, to the healthcare marketplaces created by the law. Under both systems, workers and the government both pay for insurance coverage. Like most employer-sponsored plans, the government pays a certain percentage of premiums, in this case 72%, and the workers pay the rest. That's still the case for congressional retirees. They don't get free insurance. They pay the same share of premiums as active federal employees. According to the Office of Personnel Management, retirees will be eligible to purchase insurance through the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program if they meet certain criteria. They must be eligible for retirement, and they must have been continuously enrolled in one of the government's employer-sponsored health plans for 5 years before retirement. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lurie Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lurie Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. It's a known fact that the current generation of American children is more obese than any previous generation. And at a Washington, D.C. community health center, Unity Healthcare, a pediatrician was in a quandary over how to tackle this growing health scourge. He began with a unique solution targeted to a teen patient whose body mass index, or BMI, had already landed her in the obese category. What he did was write a prescription for getting off the bus one stop earlier on her way to school. Dr. Robert Czar of Unity Community Health Center understood that without motivation to move more, kids just might not do it. The patient complied with the prescription and has moved from the obese down to the overweight category, certainly an improvement. He then decided to expand this program by working with the D.C. Parks Department, mapping out all the potential walks and play area kids have within the city's parks, mapping 380 of them so far.
How to get there? Parking. Is parking available if someone's going to drive? Bike racks.
Dr. Czar writes park prescriptions on a special prescription pad in English and Spanish with the words RX for outdoor activity and a schedule slot that asks, when and where will you play outside this week?
I like to listen and find out what it is my patients like to do and then gauge the parks I prescribe based on their interests, based on the things they're willing to do.
He wants to make the prescription for outdoor activity adaptable for all of his patients and adaptable for pediatricians around the country. He's planning to create an app for his parks database where providers and patients alike can use it. And one day, he'd like to be able to track his patients' activities in the parks. RX for outdoor activity, partnering clinicians, park administrators, patients, and their families to move more, yielding fitter, healthier young people. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at wesufm.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.